This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you all for coming again. It's nice to see familiar faces here. Tonight we have two talks, one by a good friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Thomas Satterwhite. Who's going to talk about facial feminization surgeries, and then I'm going to give a talk on vaginoplasty, which we both do. I would like to introduce Dr. Satterwhite. Dr. Thomas Satterwhite is a plastic surgeon at Brownstein and Crane Surgical Services in Greenbrae, in the South, Bay Area. He did his training, all of his training at Stanford. He went to college there, medical school, did plastic surgery residency, and then went off to Miami to do a craniofacial surgery fellowship. And he's come back to the Bay Area to work in this private surgery practice. He offers general plastic surgery procedures as well as transgender surgeries of all types for transgender women, so facial feminization, chest surgery, and vaginoplasty, and then offers chest surgery for transgender men in addition to his general plastic surgeries. He has been practicing in Marin since 2014. So with that, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Thomas Satterwhite. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, everyone. And it's definitely a pleasure and an honor to be here. And so this is a topic I could speak on for hours. I only have half an hour. but it's just once again, I did my training at Stanford, spent a year in Miami for my craniofacial fellowship, and then I came back to the Bay Area in 2014. And so Dr. Brownstein had been a big surgical advocate for the transgender community. He had been operating for decades. He retired in 2012, and then my surgical partner, Dr. Curtis Crane, came on, expanded the practice so that all surgical options are being offered for both trans men and trans women. As Dr. Garcia was saying, I came on in 2014, expanded it more to include facial procedures and then also working with transgender women. And we've gotten so busy, we've actually taken on two more surgeons. So Dr. Ming Chen, who's a urologist, and then Dr. Heidi Wittenberg, who's joined us just recently. And primarily because insurance is now covering gender confirmation surgery, we have a huge demand. So we're definitely doing everything that we can to meet that demand by taking on more and more surgeons in our practice. And so there are lots of different things that can be performed in terms of gender confirmation surgery for trans women. Vaginoplasty with Dr. Garcia, he'll be talking about that. So it's definitely the number one operation that most transgender women, so male to female patients, do want. Facial feminization surgery is also a very important operation, obviously, because a face is, you know, exposed to the world, and that's what people see to make their determination of your gender. So many patients do want that, and I'll talk about it. And then breast augmentation as well to feminize the chest. So why is a plastic surgeon involved in the care of transgender patients? And so what is plastic surgery? It's a medical specialty that's concerned with the correction or restoration of form and function. It's actually derived from the Greek word plastike, which means to shape and mold. So it has nothing to do with silicone, nothing to do with Barbie dolls. So it's basically reconstructive surgery. I view what we're doing, and I know that Dr. Garcia agrees, and anyone else is taking care of the transgender community, that everything that we're doing is reconstructive surgery. So we're aligning the body with the mind. Before the operation, what's important to consider, and this may have been touched upon in prior lectures, is that multidisciplinary care is absolutely essential for all patients. So, of course, they do need to see a mental health therapist and then multiple other professionals in the healthcare world who are going to guide the patients along. And by the time they come to me as a surgeon, they've already been appropriately evaluated to move forward with the operation. And once again, just to remind you, a mental health professional is important for assessing and diagnosing gender dysphoria. So once again, by the time they get to me, they've already, you know, lived as their particular gender in many cases for many, many years. In terms of what's the cost, most of her patients, I would say 99% of her patients are actually covered by insurance, which is awesome, which wasn't the way, you know, several years ago. So it's certainly a medically necessary, all of these are medically necessary procedures, and we don't want patients to have to incur unnecessary costs. In terms of facial feminizing surgery, as what I was saying before, your face is the window to the world. And so for a lot of women, when they come in to see me for consultation, that is the first part of their body they want an operation on. Many times, you know, women, transgender women come in and they want everything from head to toe. So facial feminization, breast augmentation, vaginoplasty. And I typically, you know, speak with them for about an hour or so and then come up with a timeline of care for our patients, because it will take some time. I can't do all of these procedures all in one sitting. And so it usually takes about a year, year and a half of operations, multiple operations, before we can achieve a fully feminized face and body. I just wanted to show examples of patients that I've taken care of when I was a craniofacial fellow. So this is a little girl actually from Mexico who had actually, it's called an encephalocele, so a portion of her brain, which was coming out through the, you know, middle of her nose. And we had her come to Children's Hospital in Miami, and we, you know, we made her a normal little girl's face. This is another woman who had nasal cancer and reconstructed her nose using tissue from her forehead. And so I definitely, you know, appreciate the face, and I'm definitely, you know, working with my patients to create a face that fits them, the face that they were supposed to be born with. It only takes, you know, a person, a child, a fraction of a second to look at the face and identify it as either male or female. And oftentimes you can just look at a portion of the face and know whether or not it's a man or a woman's face. Like if you look at this forehead, for example, is it a man or a woman? It's a man, you can tell. And I'll just go through these pretty quickly. And this is a very masculine, you know, chin. And then I'll also describe what makes something masculine and feminine. This is a feminine nose, feminine lips, same with the jaw here, feminine. And so what makes a face feminine? What makes a face masculine? So if you look here, starting from the top, a more feminine hairline is going to be rounded as opposed to a square forehead that you see here, a square hairline. The distance between the brow and the hairline is also shorter in a woman's face compared to a man's face. The eyebrows tend to be higher and arched. The eyes tend to be much more open compared to a man's face. The nose also tends to be a bit smaller. The face is going to be a bit more oval. Chin is going to be more tapered and pointed as well. And the lips tend to be a bit poutier, particularly the more volume in the upper lip. And the distance between the nose and the lip tends to be shorter in a feminine face compared to a more masculine face. Looking at a lateral or side profile view, you can see certain, you know, other differences as well. So looking at the brow, it's going to be a bit more prominent here in a male face compared to a female face. More projection of the nose in a male face compared to a female. And there's also a little bit more of an upturn of the nose in a female face as well. The jaw, as you can see here, is going to be smaller. Is going to be a bit more rounded. And the angle in a man's jaw is going to be a bit more prominent. And the Adam's apple, the thyroid cartilage, of course, is going to be a bit more obvious in a man's face. And these are just kind of craniofacial bony representations that highlight the same features between a more feminine skull and a more masculine skull. Before the operation, of course, I have the initial visit, and what's important is assessing the patient for medical readiness. I want to make sure they don't have any medical issues that are going to put them in any harm's way. And this is the case for any surgical patient, of course. I'm very strict, as most surgeons are, about smoking, because that's going to be the number one reason why anyone would have any wound healing issues. So they do have to stop smoking at least a month before and a month after the operation. I do a, you know, facial analysis, assess the dimensions of the face, and then I, most importantly, is asking the patient what their particular goals and wishes are, because I can certainly look at a face and think of things that I would want to do operatively, but I'm not going to talk about them or mention them, because I want to know specifically what the patient's interested in. I have some patients who come in, very, very masculine face. All they care about is the Adam's apple. You know, they say, this is what brings about dysphoria for me. This is what makes me feel uncomfortable going out in public. So I just want my Adam's apple shaved, and then I'm going to be completely fine. And then some patients state, oh, you can do everything on my face. except for my nose, because my nose is a part of my heritage. It represents me and my family and my culture, so I don't want you to touch that. But most patients, when they come in, they say, you know, just do what you think would be appropriate for feminizing my face. Then I do get x-rays beforehand, and that gives me a better idea of the bony structures of their face. And for surgical planning for patients, being on hormones is important, but not absolutely required when moving forward with facial feminization. So hormones like estrogen, the majority of patients do take. And what it does is it helps to soften up some of the soft tissue aspects of the face, but it really doesn't do much for the bony structures of the face, which need to be repaired operatively. In terms of the age, minimum age for patients, I would say about 19 or 20. And the reason why is because they need to have achieved skeletal maturity. So the face is still growing until your late teens and early 20s. In terms of maximum age, there's no maximum age. As long as you're healthy, you know, the operation's fine. So if you look at the side profile here, and this is an x-ray, you can see how the sinus, this is a sinus, and this is what produces that brow protrusion. You can also appreciate how large the jaw is, how the chin juts out, how the angle of the mandible, which is the back of the mandible, is quite large. So these are all features that I really want to make smaller, so feminize. The goal of feminization is basically making the small, making the face smaller and more refined. In terms of, you know, whether or not a patient's a good candidate, I follow the standards of care that are established by the World Professional Association of Transgender Health. You know, these operations don't require referral by a mental health professional, but I still do. For patients who haven't had any prior operations, I do require a letter from a mental health therapist. Long operations can be up to 12 hours. And there are multiple procedures that I do for the forehead, nose, cheeks, all aspects of the face. But I think it's probably better to just go through pictures to show you. One of the, I suppose, simplest operations to start out with is reducing the Adam's apple. So I use an incision high up in the neck. And this is under general anesthesia in most cases to access the thyroid cartilage. And this basically houses your vocal cords. So it's really important. And even though it's a simple operation, you can still have potential complications of affecting the vocal cords if not done carefully. So I do take a small portion of that cartilage to bring down the projection. So these are before and after. So this is a patient. So the head is over here and the feet are over here. And so you can see very, very big, you know, Adam's apple. Make the incision right about here and then just shave that down. And you can see how you have a much smoother contour. I'm in this patient. This is before and after, before, after. And it heals quite nicely. And before and after. And this is a patient who said, you know, this is all I want. I just want my Adam's apple taken down. I don't want anything else. And she's super happy. Another operation or another procedure is called a genioplasty, but this is basically a chin operation. And this diagram highlights lots of different things that you can do, but basically making a cut in the chin and then repositioning the bone. So the other operation that I do for the lower part of the face is addressing the mandible because it tends to be really large and bulky. So using an incision inside the mouth, I use a saw to cut off this bone right here. And I use a burr to shave all of this down. So I'm going to show some intraoperative pictures here. So these are the teeth. This is a lip pulled back. I've cut this tissue here, the gingiva, exposed the bone, and then basically cut a sliver of bone out of here to make the chin shorter. Because a more masculine chin is just going to be longer. Think of like Jay Leno, for example. Really long chin, really protrudes out. So you want to take out that sliver of bone to make it smaller. And there it is. Plates and screws are used to hold that into place. This was actually during my fellowship, but this is a young transgender woman. She was primarily concerned about the lower part of her face here and then also her nose. And this is after, and once again, before and after. And you can see that her face is in better proportion here. And the only part of her face I was operated on, once again, was the chin and then also her nose. And so basically a sliver of bone was taken out and then it was advanced forward a little bit as well, but it really does make a huge difference in feminizing her face. Yeah. Another component of facial feminization is addressing the upper part of the face or the forehead. So typically this requires an incision within the hairline and then along the hairline here and reflecting or bringing down that skin to access the underlying bony structures. So once again, intraoperative pictures, this is the top of the head. This is the bottom, so the eyes are over here, and the skin has been pulled down. And you can see this bone, that's where the frontal sinus lives here. So, and sorry, they're a little gory, so if you want to avert your eyes for a sec, but I use a saw to cut out a piece of that bone. There's the inside of the sinus. I bring the bone back, and then I use wires and screws to hold it into place. Okay, so this is a patient, mid-50s, definitely very, very masculine features. You can see a high hairline, her brows are really flat, large nose. She's got a hump on her nose here. She got a long upper lip, a big chin, so definitely lots of features. And so her operation took a while. It was about 12 hours. So this is after that you can see here. So hairline advancement made the nose smaller, made the chin smaller as well. I believe I did a little bit of fat grafting as well. And what's interesting, when you see a lot of these patients before and after, they always seem to have a little bit more of a smile. I think they're definitely much happier. If you look here side view, you can see, you know, that protrusion in her forehead, the frontal sinus, we've taken that down. Her eyes are definitely just so much more open. The nose is smaller. It's more upturned. Lips are a bit poutier. The chin is smaller. The one thing that I tell my patients, particularly for my older patients, is they can sometimes get a bit more jowling or loose skin after doing this. And the reason why is because I've taken out so much bone that there's now this excess skin laxity. So I typically have to come back in my older patients, so those over the age of about 45 or so, to do a facelift to tighten that up. And so we've actually done a facelift on her, and I'll have updated pictures. This patient, these are both before pictures, was primarily concerned about her nose. She has this hump on her nose, and it's a little bit crooked, and then also her brow and her hairline. And so these are after pictures, before and after. So I did a brow lift, hairline advancement, and then also a rhinoplasty with her nose. And particularly on the side view, you can see the difference with her nose. Made that smaller, upturned it, and then you can see brows a little... hard to see here, but you can see right there, then it's a bit higher and more arched, and that creates more of a feminine appearance for her. Definitely around the eyes, they're much more open, much more feminine for this patient. Woman in her 60s, definitely very, very, very strong masculine features, and so she needed a full facial feminization before and after for her. So I did everything from top to bottom for this patient. Which you can see, you know, just her eyes are so much more open. The brow particularly is really elevated. The nose is smaller. The lips are poutier. So it really, you know, makes a huge difference for the patient. You know, you can see the nose, it's smaller, a bit more upturned. The lips are a bit poutier. The chin is smaller. Her forehead is so much smaller as well. And she also had a facelift as well because she had excess tissue afterwards, so we had to tighten up the skin. And this is from a couple months ago, so she's doing really, really well. Super happy. This patient was just concerned about her nose. So this is before and after. So she just wanted to address the nose. And so I took down the hump, and then I did a little bit of a tip rotation as well of her nose. So before and after for this patient. Also, full facial feminization for this patient. You know, beforehand, you can see that she has very pretty eyes, and so we really wanted to accentuate those. So by doing the brow lift, it really, you know, does that. I advanced her hairline, did fat grafting to her cheeks, fat to her lips, basically taking fat from the belly and then processing it and then injecting it. And it's a great way of adding volume to the face. So before and after for this patient, and she'll also need a facelift as well at some point. But you can really see the difference in the before and after in her face and how it feminizes it. After the operation, she felt that she could go out and people were not misgendering her, that people were referring to her as her and as ma'am. And even, you know, she would go back to places that she had gone to before where they had referred to her as a, you know, as a him, and they are now consistently saying her. And so it's just wonderful, and she's definitely very happy. I've also done a breast augmentation and vaginoplasty on her as well. So this patient, very young, early 20s, did facial feminization, full facial feminization for her. And you can just see the difference, brow lift, rhinoplasty, fat grafting to the face as well. And I also did liposuction of the neck to make that a smoother contour. So you see in the neck here, she had excess tissue, and I liposuctioned that to make it a sharper angle there. But her nose is smaller, her brows are much nicer, hairline's advanced. So their faces look the same. So it's not a huge, you know, dramatic, like, oh my gosh, I don't recognize you anymore. It's still their face, but it's a more feminine version of their face. Because a lot of patients are terrified that they're going to have the operation and no one's going to recognize them, or they're not going to recognize them themselves. And this young woman, these are both before pictures, she was just concerned about the lower part of her face. And so what we did, or what I did, was a genioplasty or a chin operation. So I made the chin smaller, as you can see here, before and after, and I did some tapering of her mandible or her jaw. And even though that was the only part of her face that I operated on, it still puts her face in better proportion. It just affects the overall, I think, appearance of her face. It puts it in more balance before and after, and before and after. Additional procedures that can be performed, so facial rejuvenation, so basically creating a more youthful face. So facelift. So facelift in and of itself is not a gender confirmation surgery. This is because a facelift is basically something that's needed for facial aging, which everyone suffers, unfortunately, not just transgender patients. But I will do it for patients who have excess laxity, because I've done facial reduction and they have that excess laxity, as I've talked about. So liposuction, fat grafting, eyelid operations, and all sorts of skin treatments that patients can get, typically not covered by insurance. And then after the operation, you know, patients typically stay in the hospital. I see them multiple times, make sure they're doing well. And it's a long recovery. They're going to be bruised for a long time. The first month is usually the hardest, and I tell all of my patients that. And then usually after about a month, they're happy with their face. But it can take a full year for the face to fully heal. And so I warn my patients about that, that it's definitely going to take time. By 2 weeks, usually back to school. 3 months, I tell my patients, you'll have about 80% of your results. You'll be happy. People will be commenting on how good you look. And then by 1 year, typically have your full results. And then postoperatively, you know, just take it easy. That's what I tell all my patients, and limiting sun exposure just so that you don't get any scarring. And in terms of complications, so the big thing that I always worry about for all of these procedures is actually bleeding. The face is a very richly vascular area. And so there's about, you know, in general, about a 5 to 10% chance of a hematoma or bleeding. So patients need to do whatever they can to minimize bleeding. So minimizing any strenuous activity, minimizing the use of NSAIDs like aspirin or Aleve or ibuprofen, sleeping with their head elevated, lots of ice to the area is going to be super important for these patients. But in general, folks do quite well. The area tends to heal very well with very minimal scarring. The other thing that I tell patients is that portions of their face are going to be numb. The chin tends to be numb, and the top of the head, the scalp, tends to be numb for months, maybe even up to a year, because some nerves are damaged during that, and it takes some time for those to regrow. I'm going to move on to breast augmentation here. I think I have a couple minutes, and then we'll have questions. This is a masculine and a feminine chest, and we instantly recognize that. So a more feminine chest, musculature in most cases is not as defined. The areolas and nipples tend to be larger and tend to be located a bit more to the middle part of the chest, as compared to a more masculine chest. And so these are, you know, components that I'm trying to recreate as best as I can during a breast augmentation. And for folks who do undergo chest reconstruction or breast augmentation, once again, they have to meet the guidelines or the criteria that are set by the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, and they have very clear guidelines. What I do require is one referral letter from a mental health therapist stating that this is an operation they would benefit from, and that hormones typically they need to be on prior to the operation. And the reason why is because hormones like estrogen will actually bring about breast development. So they need to be on hormones for at least a year. Sometimes, in most cases, I say at least 2 years, so that they can maximize their breast development before doing chest reconstruction. Because the problem is we put in the implants and then they start using our hormones, then the breast development can occur in a completely different place from the implants, and it just would not look very good. Once again, you know, medical history, physical exam, get their measurements, and then goals and wishes. Majority of my patients want to look natural. They come in, they say, I want to look proportional, I want to look natural. I've had a couple of patients who say, you know, I want to look as big as possible. I want to look like I have a breast augmentation. But few and far between, majority of patients just want to be proportional. Lots of different options. I'll touch upon them. So incisions can be placed under the arm, around the nipple, under the breast. Lots of different ways that you can do, and I won't go into detail about that. In terms of implant placement, the implant can typically be placed on top of the muscle, or it can be placed behind the muscle. I actually prefer to place the implant under the muscle, and the reason why is because it provides more soft tissue coverage over the implant. A lot of these patients have very, very, very minimal breast tissue, so if you place the implant on top of the muscle, you're going to see the edges of the implant. You're going to see rippling. So by putting it under the muscle, you get more tissue covering it, so it actually looks a bit more natural. And it doesn't affect function. So patients can still use their arms. It's not going to affect their ability to exercise. There's saline implants and silicone implants. I tend to prefer silicone implants. They actually feel softer in general and feel more natural and look natural compared to saline implants. And they don't have any negative health consequences. There was a time when there was a moratorium on silicone implants in the 90s, but that had since been lifted because they thought that there were issues, but certainly not the case. My preference is to place the implant under the breast in what's referred to as the inframammary fold. It's about a 2-inch incision. It's really well concealed. As I said, placing it under the muscle, and I like to use silicone, particularly shaped implants. And you may have heard of, you know, cohesive gel or gummy bear or teardrop implants. That's basically implants that look like a breast, so they have a more natural appearance. And it prevents patients from getting that overly done look, and I'm sure you've seen this in magazines or on TV where it looks like someone took a cantaloupe and cut it in half and pasted it on their chest. You know, it's like, oh, that's a really bad breast augmentation. Patients want to look natural. So these are after pictures, actually, of this particular patient. So very natural appearance. It has a nice slope and then that fullness in the bottom part of the chest. That's what you want to see. You don't want to see this big lump in the top part of the chest. So very natural. You wouldn't think that this patient had a breast augmentation. Before and after for this particular patient with the anatomic implants. And you can see here, you know, a nice shape here and then fullness at the bottom. And that's what we want. So before and after. This patient had very, very minimal breast tissue, and she had been on hormones for years, but just did not develop a lot of breast tissue, and most patients don't. And then with the breast augmentation, with those anatomic implants, a really nice shape that you see there. Once again, before and after for this patient. And before and after for this patient. She was a little bit early on, so you can still see a little bit of the scar, but it's since faded. And they look very natural, and these are actually very large implants. They're about 600 cc's, which is a good size, but she's a large woman. A lot of my patients are on the large size, understandably, so they can accommodate really large implants and look really, really good. Very natural appearance. You know, you wouldn't say that these, you know, look like, you know, breast augmentation. She's definitely very happy. And even the areola, which is a dark part right here, is stretched out a bit and has become more feminine. So it looks really nice. Another alternative is fat grafting. I've done this on a few patients where fat can be taken from typically the belly or the inner thighs, and then process and inject it into the chest, so before and after. Very, very minimal gains you can typically get. This is actually a non-transgender woman, but before and after. Probably, you know, went up maybe a cup size, but very, very minimal gains. And I do have some patients where they don't want to have implants, they don't want foreign material, they want to use their own tissue, and so they opt to go for fat grafting or fat transfer. And then potential complications, it's a relatively low-risk operation, but particular things to keep in mind is that patients can develop a rupture. It's about a 1% chance of that, so they do have to get MRIs every few years to detect for that. Infection tends to be pretty rare. You can get contractures or scar tissue around the implant, which happens at about 3 to 5%, and that scar tissue needs to be taken out and the implants need to be taken out. But overall, patients do quite well. And there are additional procedures that can be done, body feminization procedures, overall body rejuvenation procedures that can be done. And something that I emphasize to all of my patients and just everyone in general is to not inject silicone in any part of your body, because that will lead to really, really bad things, infections, granulomas, just horrible things. And so there are a lot of trans women, a lot of folks who go to other countries to get cosmetic surgery, and even within this country, unfortunately, and they see someone who's not really a medical professional and is just doing it for money and will inject parts of their body with silicone. It looks good for a couple of years, but then usually leads to horrible complications. So silicone shouldn't be injected. This is what's referred to as a Brazilian butt lift. I took fat from the belly and from the back, processed it, and injected it into her butt to give it more fullness and a more feminine contour. So before and after for this patient. And then also abdominoplasties and tummy tuck, so before and after for this patient. So kind of a standard plastic surgery procedure, but something I also offer to my patients. Well, thank you. Any questions from the audience? Go ahead.
Does insurance pay for the facial?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is, does insurance pay for facial feminization surgery? Some do, some don't. And it's a bit tricky because there are many insurance companies that still view it as cosmetic surgery. So they're not covering it. Right now, insurance companies that are most consistently covering facial feminization are usually, you know, private insurance companies or insurance companies from progressive companies like Google or Yahoo, who are willing to, you know, provide all types of coverage. But right now, it's not consistent in that respect. Yeah. Vaginoplasties definitely are. Breast augmentations are. There was a time when breast augmentation was not being covered consistently. About 2 years ago, it was definitely a fight, and a lot of insurance companies were saying that it's all cosmetic. Right now, majority of insurance companies are covering breast augmentation. So my hope is that facial feminization will get covered because it is medically necessary and it is recognized in the literature and in the community as being medically necessary. Other questions? Okay. Go ahead.
So, in regards to the fat, taking the fat, putting it in, are you sucking the fat out through the incision? So there's healing on the fat area as well as where you put it.
Yeah, so the question is about the fat grafting procedures. What's the process that's involved in taking out the fat? So I essentially use standard liposuction technique, and you may have seen this on TV or on YouTube, but basically using like a cannula and making tiny little holes, you know, usually low down in the abdomen and sucking out the fat using a wand or a cannula. And that's put into a canister. And that's processed, basically centrifuged or sifted out to take out all the liquid. And then I just have these little tubes of fat that I just inject with tiny little cannulas throughout the face or whatever body part I'm working with. So it's essentially a standard liposuction that I'm using. And so patients get, you know, two things. They get, you know, a liposuction wherever I'm taking the fat from, typically the belly. And then they also get, you know, more volume in their face or in their chest. So it's you get two for one.
Dr. Satterwhite, that was a great talk. I wanted to ask you, what is your experience with the durability of fat grafting? And then the second was, in your experience, what facial feminization, what areas, anatomic areas, do people tend to kind of focus most on to address their gender dysphoria?
Sure. So the first question is how long fat takes. You know, so what's the reliability? So it can be unpredictable. And so what I tell all of my patients is that, you know, about 50% of the fat typically will go away. And so I tend to over graft or overfill the areas because I know that's going to be the case. Fat loves to stay. There's certain body parts where the fat really likes to stay. The fat really likes to stay in the butt. As long, I tell all of my patients, you can't sit on your butt for 3 weeks after the operation. So if there's any compression, that can cause some degree of fat loss. Fat loves to stay in the cheeks, will stay there for a long time. Fat does not like the lips. I found that fat tends to go away, and I don't know if it's because there's a lot more motion in the lips or there's less blood supply. I don't know, but fat in the lips tends to be very, very, very unpredictable. Fat in the breast tends to stay very well. Yeah, and the reason why, I don't know. I really don't know. And then the other question is, what aspects of facial feminization are most sought after for patients? I would say it's the forehead. I would say it's the brow shave, bringing that back. Because, you know, it's a very, very distinctly male quality having this prominent brow. And that's what most patients want to take down. And then secondly, I would probably say the chin and the jaw. Yeah. Go ahead.
Points about facial feminization. I'm thinking about the other side, trans men. Do any kind of those surgeries, and what is happening here?
Yeah. So the question is, you know, what surgical options are there for trans men? And it's interesting. Most trans men do not seek facial masculinization. Usually they take testosterone and they grow facial hair, and they're usually fine with that. And I think you have to think about it on a cultural level, because if someone has a somewhat feminine face and they identify as male, they're still seen as attractive. They're seen as cute and young, right? As opposed to someone who identifies as female, and heaven forbid they have one single masculine quality in their face, it's just they're viewed in a negative fashion. So that's why on that level, facial masculinization is not pursued. But when it is done, I mean, things that can be done are implants. So putting in chin implants to make the chin bigger, putting in mandible implants to make the mandible bigger. There have been some descriptions of actually putting, you know, cartilage in the Adam's apple to make that bigger as well. But in general, it's very, very, very rare. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, so the question is, does public insurance cover these operations? And yes. And so we've actually had several Medi-Cal patients who have undergone facial feminization surgery as well as breast augmentation. Yes.
And is changing in insurance coverage, is that related to the Affordable Care Act, or is that separate?
The question is, the changing insurance, is that related to the Affordable Care Act? And Dr. Garcia might know the answer better than me, but I think it is, but yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the Affordable Care Act and legislation in the last 2-3 years, particularly in California, have just brought about the prohibition of exclusionary riders to deny people surgery to treat this condition of gender dysphoria. Again, going out of their way to define it not as cosmetic surgery. So it is. The challenge, I've been working with a group in LA, Medi-Cal group, the challenge is there are finite resources. A system can't cover every surgery under the sun. So, you know, it's a little bit easier to draw a line around genital surgery, but with some of these other procedures, that's the challenge, is sort of figuring out how to support this, but in a way that everyone gets to have surgery. And that's where at least this big LA plan is. So,
yeah, that's a good point, because there certainly is a mandate that, you know, all managed Medi-Cal should cover gender confirmation surgery, but they're still viewing facial feminization as cosmetic surgery. So that's been our battle. There's certainly some components of facial feminization that are definitely reconstructive. So bringing back the forehead, recontouring the forehead, recontouring the chin and the jaw. But there's certainly aspects that might be a little bit in the gray area, such as a rhinoplasty or a nose operation. Certainly a facelift is cosmetic. So that's why it can be a bit difficult in that respect. Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Satterwhite, that was great. Thank you.
So good evening. My name is Maurice Garcia. I'm an associate professor of urology here at UCSF. Just assistant here, but I'm associate, or just advanced.
And I lead our transgender genital surgery program, so surgery of the genital area, offer both male to female and female to male surgeries, and I am active in that, and also education and research, basic and clinical research. And it's a real pleasure for me to be here tonight to talk to you about gender confirming surgery. Some call it gender affirming surgery. Terminology, as I think Drs. Karasik and Hastings talked about last week, is an ever changing thing. And again, we try to keep up with terminology that's respectful of people. And as we get to understand everyone in the group, we're changing our terminology. So I don't have any real disclosures relevant to this talk. To give a little overview of what we're going to talk about, I'm going to cover transgender sort of terminology very briefly, because it was covered in much greater depth last week, and epidemiology, some care guidelines, criteria for surgery, for genital surgery, some surgery overview, focusing today on male to female. We're going to leave female to male for next week. And then talking about gender confirming or affirming surgery in the U.S. today. A couple of comments on insurance, because I think people find that important and interesting and relevant, and then the role of urology in all of this. So very briefly, how did I get here? I did my training here at UCSF for residency in urology, and I got involved in this, taking care of patients in this community, and I ended up doing getting interested in the sort of the fact that they've been marginalized, I think, historically, across the boards, and in medicine, and particularly with respect to surgery. And I just sort of got interested in some of the challenges they faced, and then, of course, interested in the surgeries. And I made a case for UCSF to really invest in bringing this care to this community, because it's in line with our mission statement. We're state institution caring for underserved populations and bringing innovation, particularly to underserved populations and also fields, as part of what we do and what we're dedicated to. So the university was extraordinarily supportive. I went off and got training in the UK, a little bit of training in Belgium, but mainly in the UK. And I came back and started our program here. And I want to emphasize, it's a multidisciplinary program. So I do genital surgery, but I have colleagues that are equals in psychiatry, primary care, plastic surgery, dermatology, gynecology, really every discipline that has something to contribute to care and research. Very briefly, just a little review about terminology, because I think some of you may not be at all the lectures. So gender is a complex sort of internal sense of being, whether it's male, female, or other. It's more than a binary dichotomy. Sex is, however, is a matter of the body. It's while gender occurs in the mind, sex and sexual identity refers to, I've heard it described, gender is who you go to bed as, sexual identity is who you go to bed with. So they're different things, but it's important to emphasize gender identity is not sexual orientation. I think it's a pitfall that a lot of people fall into in terms of making assumptions about people. Transgender is a term for people whose identity, expression, behavior, and general sense of self do not conform to what's associated with their birth sex in the place they were born. And in the place they were born is very important. Gender is a very culturally contexted construct. Gender identity disorder is a historical term. It's very pathologizing, and now it's referred to as gender dysphoria. It's interesting to note, in the 70s, the DSM, the big manual for psychiatric conditions and diagnoses, viewed declassified homosexuality as a mental disorder. And I think we're trying to move away from labeling things disorder when they really aren't. Gender dysphoria is a term for the discomfort, distress, and distress caused by a discrepancy between a person's gender identity and their sex assigned at birth.
Gender nonconforming is an important term to be familiar with. It refers to the degree to which a person's gender identity, role, or expression differs from the cultural norms, again, cultural relevance here, prescribed for the male or female sex in that cultural milieu. So being transgender, gender nonconforming, is a matter of diversity and not pathology. And I'd add to that, it's a matter of context, too. And gender-confirming surgery, or as we're, some call it, as we're calling it here, gender-affirming surgery, we're saying the same thing, is surgery designed is surgery intended to make a person's body more in line with or identified with gender. The term sex reassignment surgery is an older term, and again, a little bit, just to many, it's a little bit paternalistic. It's not as patient-centered as gender-affirming. Let's talk a little bit about epidemiology. I think as a rule, for those that have looked at, you know, the just how common being transgender is, there's universal agreement that it's grossly underestimated. I think the best estimate came out about 6 months ago is in the cover of the New York Times. A group at UCLA did some very nice census work for all 50 states and found that 0.6% of the U.S. population identifies as transgender. That equals 1.4 million people. And surprisingly, the state with the most people that identify as transgender is not California. The top place per capita is actually not a state. It's Washington, D.C. And the first actual state is Hawaii. California is only second. So this is something that's just, it exists all around us. There are transgender people everywhere. And as we're all in agreement, we have to care for them and give them good care. This is just a little slide of a list of epidemiologic studies stratified by time. So the top ones are the oldest studies and the bottom ones are the newest. And just every study after the next calculates new numbers for the incidence and prevalence of this. Currently we're at 0.6% of the 0.6% of the population. Treatment and need. Gender dysphoria can be alleviated with treatment, therapy with hormones, with or without surgery, but I think it's important to remember that treatment is individualized, and for many people doesn't require surgery. And also, treatment, whether it's social transition or taking hormones or surgery, different people stratify things, those things differently in terms of what's important for them. They can prioritize things very differently. Genital surgery, and with respect to surgery, genital surgery versus chest surgery versus facial feminization surgery versus voice surgery. Again, people want different things. So there's no cookie-cutter approach to this. I think it's important. I think facial feminization surgery is important because I have a lot of patients who will tell me the most important thing for them is facial feminization surgery. And genital surgery is also important, but a little bit less so. So when you hear things like that, you have to kind of respect that there are other fields, even if it's out of my own, that are very important. So I'm a proponent of that. I try to support it however I can. Professional care guidelines, as Dr. Satterwhite already mentioned, there's the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. That is the leading, it's actually an international body comprised of healthcare professionals, both on the surgical and non-surgical side. They set out the standards of care, but the standards of care itself says these are recommended guidelines intended for people across the world. Different countries have different conditions, different constraints. So these are, we intend these guidelines to be taken with some flexibility. Again, culturally and socially relevant implementation of these things. But we generally, certainly in my practice, and it sounds like Dr. Satterwhite and certainly other people that I know adhere to these. It's important to note that the government, all major insurance companies now default to WPATH guidelines. So I think they're rapidly becoming standard. And I think they're very thoughtful. I would encourage you all to look at them. They're free online. There's a big PDF. Look for WPATH standards of care guidelines. There's different versions. The last one is version 7, but there's another one due out soon. WPATH is the most established and the only international professional association for transgender health. So criteria for genital surgery. It's at least a year. This is per WPATH guidelines and my own guidelines here at UCSF and many other places. It's at least a year of mental health care or therapy at some point. It doesn't have to be active at the time of surgery. Hormone therapy for at least a year. At least a year of social transition, that is full-time life, living in the identified with gender, and then two referral letters from mental health professionals recommending the person's readiness for genital gender-affirming surgery. This does not have to be a psychiatrist or a physician. It could be a psychologist, a master's, you know, MFT, and so forth. And I think that we may be moving to a one-letter requirement because two letters is very onerous for a lot of people. I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit about male to female gender-affirming surgeries. There are several. We sort of generalize and say vaginoplasty is the main one, and in many ways it is. But there's also bilateral. But some of these can be offered in part before vaginoplasty. I'm a big believer that bilateral orchiectomy has a lot of medical benefit to patients. That's removal of the testicles. It allows people to stop one of their medications, an antiandrogen, which is a diuretic and makes people urinate frequently. It often lets people decrease their estrogen, their dependence on estrogen doses by about half, in my experience. Estrogen, like in the birth control pill, is deleterious to the cardiovascular system, so a lower dose is actually healthier. And especially for people that are smokers or have it at high risk for blood clots, called DVTs, deep venous thrombosis, lowering your estrogen is especially beneficial for them because they're already at high risk for clots and such. So it's has a lot of benefit. I think people also just feel better when they've had their testicles removed. It can be done in a way that's safe and does not put future vaginoplasty at risk, meaning burning any bridges or diminishing the outcomes with future vaginoplasty. I do it by a midline scrotal incision close to the top of the scrotum, and I remove both testicles through one incision. Future vaginoplasty incision is through the midline anyway, so the incision is where the future incision will be. And then I'm careful to spare this fat pedicle associated with the spermatic cord, which can be used later to support the labia majora. I think patient expectations, as Dr. Satterwhite and others would agree, is, and anyone in medicine and surgery, is very important, particularly surgery, because it's important to manage patient expectations realistically and in a sensitive way. This is something called, I like to review this with patients, to convey three very important points. First, let me show you the artwork. The artwork it's literally called the Great Wall of Vagina. There's an artist in Brighton, England named Jamie McCartney who has taken plaster casts of, I think, 300 plus women, most all natal women, so assigned sex female at birth. And you know, you just see these panels of these vaginas, and I think a beautiful point that can be made from this is that they're all different. There's no cookie cutter. There's no standard perfect, you know, vagina. So they're all different. There's no gold standard. The second point is that, you know, there's limited tissue available. So it's not possible with vaginoplasty to make overly pronounced labia majora. And some women not naturally have big labia majora, but many don't. So it's within the spectrum of normal. Most women prefer less prominent ones anyway, which is good. But anyway, I can make that point. And then the last point is that I think a lot of women, sort of like men, can focus on the length of the penis or the size of the penis. Some women come into this thinking that they have to have a very deep vagina to be sort of maximally feminine or to be able to, you know, it's just important in a sort of similar way, like it reflects sort of sexual potency or something. And I think, you know, not everyone can achieve that based on the skin that they have. So a point I like to make with this panel is that, look, vaginal depth is just not something, these are all vaginas. You look at that, you instantly say that's a vagina. But depth is not something that is part of that rapid assessment of, you know, of appearance. So, you know, It doesn't define whether something is or is not a vagina. The two techniques for vaginoplasty, penile inversion, which is the most common, where we take the skin of the penis and separate it, free it from the penis, and then invert it, and then pass it into a cavity that we make for the vaginal space. So the vagina is lined by that skin, the skin originally from the penis. For people, particularly in the United States, that are circumcised, circumcision is much more common here. People that don't have much penile skin, they are limited as to how much vaginal depth they can get because there's not enough skin to line it. For those people, we can use different options. We can use some of the scrotal skin and, you know, make two pedicles and join them together and then invert that. This is a pedicle scrotal flap. There's free flaps. We can take pieces of scrotal skin off and use that. That has a slightly higher risk of not taking. And then there's intestinal vaginoplasty is another option, which we'll cover. The first thing that I do when I do vaginoplasty is make a perineal incision and focus on making the cavity. So the cavity is going to be just behind the prostate and the bladder, which are here. This is the prostate, and this is the bladder. And this is the rectum back here. And this little blue line is something called a non-vase fascia, which is like a tough fascia that separates the prostate and bladder in front and the rectum behind. And the vagina should really be just in front of that, that is on the bladder side of that. And, you know, I get into this space sharply by rotating the prostate and then making an incision and putting a retractor in there and getting access to it as early as possible. There are different ways of doing this, too. Here's the perineal incision, and just to put it in context, and then here's the approach. And here on the left of the left surgical picture, you see the cavity made, and then on the right, it's packed with some white gauze. The next thing we do is remove the testicles. I remove them through the same incision. There's that little fat pedicle here, some fat that we'll spare. This yellow stuff is the fat, and I'm holding the testicle here, and we're going to spare that, and then later bring that fat down to here to kind of support the labia majora, which will be like little hills. And then we work on separating the penis from the penis skin, so dissecting in a plane between Buck's fascia, which is this kind of tough covering, and then Coley's fascia here. This is this tissue here will stay with the skin of the penis, which will of course line the vagina. This is a cross section, of course, of the penis, urethra, the two spongy shafts of skin, of tissue that get full with blood and get erect, and then here are the nerves to the penis and so forth. During the surgery, here the penis has already been separated from its skin. The skin is kind of laying up here, and the urethra runs all the way to the tip of the penis. Well, we shorten the urethra and leave it here. In a woman, of course, the urethra is naturally much shorter than in a man. The glands or the head of the penis is marked. The clitoris is actually going to be part of the glands. There are different ways of marking it these days. I make more of a sort of an incision like this, but suffice it to say, we take a portion of the front of the head of the penis and keep the nerves and the vessels that run along the top of the penis, and this will be the new clitoris. And surprisingly, not surprisingly to me, but perhaps surprisingly to others, it gives excellent erogenous sensation, and the vast majority of patients can have an orgasm of equal quality after surgery just from their new clitoris. So here's sort of the glands incision in a side view. And all of this stuff here will be discarded. We're just going to keep this little bit of tissue and then the nerves and the vessels. The neoclitoris is dissected away from the penis. And here we have the penis kind of pointing down, missing that little bit of glands. And then here's that little bit of glands, and it's the nerves and the vessels running in like a little ribbon of tissue. And that's what will be the clitoris. There's the neurovascular bundle, and then that kind of triangle shaped piece of glands. The remaining penile tissue is then excised, removed, and then it leaves a little stump of shaft. We call the two rods of spongy tissue the corpora of the penis. Those that will be over chopped and then oversewn. And it's really, we're really recreating natal feminine anatomy. Women have a clitoris, which is the homologue to the tip of the male penis. They look sort of similar, although it's much smaller in a woman. And then the shaft of the clitoris is really the shaft of a penis as well. So we're, even though this, the shaft on a man, natal male, is much bigger. When we cut it and then oversew it, it makes like a little base onto which we'll attach the clitoris. So here's the clitoris. It looked like a little triangle bit of tissue. I sort of fashion it to make it look like a clitoris. Sew it together. It looks like a little drop. Here's the oversewn stump of the clitoris of the corpora, and then this is the bit of urethra that we haven't really done anything with yet. That tube of urethra will also be shortened and brought up to reach the clitoris. So this is old urethral skin, and now the urethral opening is right here where that red light is, and that's where the patient will urinate through. The purpose of this is to really give kind of a pink, natural-appearing back wall of the vagina. You've got a clitoris, we'll make a skin hood for it, and then the urethra, and then the urethral opening here. Just as in a natal, woman. The penile skin tube is then inverted, and then the end is oversewn. And then this end will get dunked, the end of this skin tube will get dunked in this black hole in this picture here. That's the cavity that we've created, just like that. When we do that, of course, skin that used to be above the base of the penis gets pulled down. And it blocks, at this point, it's blocking the clitoris and the urethral opening. So we have to make a little incision through that to let the urethra and the clitoris out into the world. So we mark that with, mark it with an ink marking pen, then we'll make a little incision and let those protrude through. They're brought through. There's the clitoris before we've made a skin hood for it. There's a catheter in the urethra, and there's this sort of pink wall. The suprapubic skin is then marked, and we remove some of it. Well, we can remove some of it, or we can fold it in different ways to make a nice hood for the clitoris. And I'll show you some nicer pictures. This is one way of doing it. I wanted to show it because it's one of the more complicated ways. We can mark this out and remove some of the skin in the center and then bring these skin edges, the arms of the A, over in the middle, and that creates a little hood of skin. It's important that the inside of the hood be lined with skin so that, because skin sheds cells and oil and all that, and we need that to be able to exit the body. So you can make a hood this way. There's other ways of making it, and I'll show you some after pictures. But here's a skin hood on a woman, a woman born as a woman that is assigned birth, female gender at birth. There's a little skin hood here, and we sort of end up recreating something like that. Another technique is that we bring skin over the clitoris and then close it with stitches, and then with time those stitches dissolve and the clitoris will naturally drop down and be only partially obscured by the skin hood, just as on a natal woman. At the end of the surgery, we pack some Vaseline gauze, there's other packings that we've used, into the vaginal cavity, and then I put a kind of a compression dressing over the area, and then the women will, my patients will stay in bed for about 5 days. And that's to help the vaginal tube stick on the inside to the surrounding part of the body of the pelvis. Generally, our post-op pathway here is they're on bed rest till the fifth day after surgery. They get compression stockings and subcutaneous heparin to lower the risk of blood clots. On the fifth day, I remove the packing in the morning, and they start dilating and douching that same day, and they can go home that same day or the next day, with whatever their preference, depending on where they live and stuff. Complications are really minimal. These are from a couple months ago, but out of 61 cases, we've had no
We've only had two major major complications. In one patient, there was loss of the clitoris, and I had to bring her back to the operating room. This is a patient that one patient accounted for both of these. Someone that came to me with she'd had a congenital malformation of her penis, so the surgery was especially challenging. But these complications happen. I think one of the things we're most afraid of are rectal injuries. These happen to all surgeons. The rectum is just behind the vaginal space, and it's easy. We're not very far from it, so it's possible to damage it. And that's one of the things we all work hard to avoid. And then blood transfusion. Generally, there's not a lot of blood loss in these cases. Minor complications, I don't even think it's fair to call them complications because I think they're so common. Granulation tissue. At first, I thought it was about 25%. I think about half of my patients get some granulation tissue at some point. It's just little red tissue that it's part of healing. It's common to other surgeries as well, to stomas and stuff. It's more of a nuisance. We just treat it with a little chemical, and it eventually stops growing back. It's healing tissue is what it is. And then sometimes people can lose a stitch or two I'll show you in a second where, but at their vaginal opening. We don't really do anything about that surgically. We just let it heal, and it always heals up nicely. So here's sort of that skin hood. The clitoris, this is a patient now after surgery, and her clitoris is here, and there's a skin hood. If you pull that up, the clitoris will be more visible, just like in a natal woman, and her thin labia. Again, as I told you at the beginning, I tell patients, you know, your labia are not going to be especially pronounced because there's not that type of skin down there. And then the vaginal opening is here. There's a glove finger in there. I've done a lot of work with cadavers. I've done vaginoplasty on human cadavers to better understand things and for teaching. And here's a human cadaver that had vaginoplasty after death. It's actually a very older person who generously donated their body to science to let us do this, but like an 80-year-old person. But here's the left leg, and then here is, let me just orient you, this round white thing is their pubic bone. It's been cut. And then their neoclitoris is here. The opening to their vagina is right here. It's this long tube. It's big like that because I packed it with something before we preserved it in formalin, so it sort of kept its big shape from the packing. But normally that tube is, just like any other tube in our body, is sort of squashed down and closed. It's a potential space. It's not an open space. So there's the vagina. And then the urinary opening, the urethra, is where this purple wire is coming through here. And then here's the bladder, this round structure here. So you can kind of appreciate we're really a hair's breadth from the rectum. The neovagina skin is probably about a millimeter or 2 millimeters in thickness, and it's about a couple millimeters from the rectum. We've done transrectal ultrasound and MRI and stuff and in patients after the surgery, and it really is very small, a very thin bit of thickness. Here's some nice pictures. This is a patient 5 months after surgery. So these are some pictures. You know, obviously after surgery, things are healing. 3 months, you know, the scar lines, they're still kind of visible. Luckily, for many people, they're covered in hair and stuff. And then I thought this was nice. This is a woman, her legs are up but not spread in this picture. Here they're kind of spread, and you start to see the clitoris in view. You don't really see it here. And then here you see the clitoris in view. She's a dark-skinned, so you can see the tissue that came from the urethra that we open up like a flower. Here, that pink tissue, the urethral opening is right where that red dot is. And then the vaginal opening, you can see kind of a skin fold. The vaginal opening is separate, and that's right here. And she had about four-fifths inches of depth, good depth, and sexually active and happy. Obviously, not all, you know, a heavier patient will look a little different. An older patient will look a little different, but that's our bodies. This person was a patient of mine was 41.
and in good health. So I'm going to kind of quickly move along here. Another surgical option for patients is intestinal vaginoplasty for people who either don't have enough skin to make a cavity that's sufficiently deep, or for women who've lost their vagina cavity because it's scarred down. We can offer this option. We take a segment of bowel. Historically, it's been a sigmoid colon. I'm using ascending colon. Other people use different types of bowel. Arguments can be made for each. But basically, we bring that piece of bowel down, and the end of it, like this end, would open up into this end would be flipped down and brought to the opening of the vagina, and the other end is closed off, and that becomes the lining of the vagina. The chief benefit of it is that it's got good depth and they're very durable. The risks, it's an additional abdominal surgery. And patients who are especially heavy set can't really, it's extra challenging, so we tend not to do them until they've lost weight. I think this is an extremely important surgical option, which is zero-depth vaginoplasty. Some women don't anticipate having receptive intercourse with a penis or with anything else, a toy or anything else. People don't have partners, aren't sexually active. Other people are just not able to dilate. So recall that with vaginoplasty, with a cavity, they have to commit to lifelong dilation, putting a dilator in to keep that vaginal space open, and also douching it because the vagina is not self-cleaning. So they have to do this. And for people for whom that's not an option or a desire, we can make the exact same vagina, the vaginas that we saw on the Great Wall of Vagina, but without a cavity. It's also a good choice for patients who've had rectal area radiation, such as for anal cancer. Faster recovery. They get the same benefits. They get a clitoris that, in all likelihood, will give them great orgasmic function. They get aesthetically the same vagina, just without that space, that cavity. And I think this should be offered to all patients. Common questions: can they achieve orgasm, or can patients achieve orgasm with their clitoris after surgery? Absolutely. In my series, every single patient has been able to achieve it. I think a big predictor is how well they can achieve an orgasm before surgery. People who have a lot of severe gender dysphoria and haven't been sexually active or touching themselves may find it more challenging, but if we help them, they can. Erogenous or sexual sensation in and around the vulva, yes. It's less than this, but they can achieve that. They have it. Quality of orgasm, many will say it's better than before surgery. And of those people, the majority will say, I know it's in my head, but it just feels more natural to finally have an orgasm with the body I was intended to have. But so I think it's better. Average depth is anywhere from 4 to 5.5, 6 inches. What happens if I stop dilating? I tell them your vagina will close. And that's a lesson. Everyone has had patients who've lost a vagina. And that's very important. So I emphasize that. Is the vagina self-lubricating? No. That's one of the few differences in a natal woman. So they have to use lubricant. There may be some sort of pre-ejaculate fluid that comes from the prostate, which we don't remove, by the way, that can serve as a lubricant. But in general, it's not. Satisfaction is extraordinarily high, and regret is extraordinarily rare. Pre- and post-surgery challenges. Sexual function can be complicated by post-operative challenges, fluctuations in their hormone therapy, cancer treatment, aging. There's not a lot written about these patients in their geriatric years. So there's still a lot to be learned about that. But aging affects us all in many different ways, and I think sexual function is one of the ways. Sexual function can be complicated by postoperative challenges, delayed wound healing, strictures either of the vagina or the urethra, and loss of some or all of the clitoris. I see a lot of, a number of revision cases, vaginoplasty done in somewhere without a lot of experience, and you sort of don't quite know what's what. This is a patient who's the tip of her penis was never even reduced and just dunked into her scrotum. Stenosis or scarring shut of the urethra or the vagina. Sexual dysfunction before and after surgery is very important. Again, at the end of the day, we're all human. These are people, and people have common problems. So sexual involvement, you know, we talk about counseling, physical therapy, use of lubricants, dilators, vibrators. I really am a proponent of use of vibrators, not so much for sex, but to help stimulate erogenous sensation and gain practice and familiarity with that. And I think addressing comorbidities like diabetes and weight loss. I'm going to go a little faster here. I do encourage self-stimulation a lot. Again, not so much for the pleasure, but for the experience achieving pleasure and to gain familiarity with what is essentially sort of new geography for people down below. I think Kegel exercises are super important, both to relax their pelvic floor muscles and also for sexual benefit, sexual function benefit. Evidence-based research, we're at a teaching institution. A lot of work that I do and with my colleagues, medical student teaching and curriculum, cadaver labs, teaching events. I think this is sort of part of, work at the university level that someone should needs to do to help bring this field forward, and a lot of people in the world do it. A lot of members of WPATH. Development of surgical devices is something that's of interest to me, specific for these surgeries, penile prosthetics and surgical instruments, and then educational apps. Department chair, Dr. Carroll, and I developed this free app on iTunes called Kegel Nation. It's a biofeedback app. It has educational materials about how to relax your pelvic floor muscles, and we've adapted this to do research, and I have a transgender version coming out shortly. It'll also be free, and it's really just a vehicle for educational material and also to help people learn how to relax their pelvic floor muscles, which is extremely important with dilation. Very briefly, insurance coverage for genital gender-affirming surgeries. It's now covered by Medi-Cal in California. Medicare and all commercial insurance plans have to offer it. And I think that's very quickly going to be the future for the rest of the country. The VA system is already talking about offering it. So it's a matter of time. I think we're just recognizing that we have to be equal and fair. The role of the surgeon, I think, a lot of the long-term complications of these surgeries are sexual and urinary related, which are things that, we in urology love to focus on. I think the role of a urologist and of other surgeons, I think, is to be collegial and to provide support to patients and to each other as surgeons in a multidisciplinary way. So urologists and plastic surgeons and gynecologists work together, and we all work together with our psychiatry colleagues and mental health colleagues, primary care, endocrine, OB-GYN, dermatology. I think geriatric medicine is something of the future, too. You never hear about that, but these patients are getting older, and I think we'll face the same issues our other geriatric patients face. And in conclusion, I think there's so much we could say in conclusion, but I think there's a huge need for transgender surgical care today, and I think for quality care. This is a fascinating field. I think this is a vulnerable, historically vulnerable and marginalized population that is as deserving of top quality care as all of us. Patients are increasingly well cared for in our community by mental health providers and medical providers. Many of our patients are now quite ready for surgery, and our outcomes are good. Patients in this evolving field need expertise from all fields of medicine, urology, plastic surgery, all of them. So we all have something to contribute, and we should be, including education and move this field forward and mature it. Thank you very much. We have a couple of minutes for some questions. Yes.
So I have a question about the criteria. So with hormone replacement, they'll be going to an endocrinologist. However, the mental health and the hormone, this is all happening at once. Is that correct? Or does
no.
The endocrinologist say, get some...
So the question is patients that get hormones go see an endocrinologist, and then do they see a mental health professional at the same time? First of all, the majority of people don't see endocrinologists for hormone therapy. This is now, there's excellent care given by primary care providers who have specialty training and experience in managing and prescribing and managing hormones in transgender men and women. So I know a number of people. Dr. Jennifer Hastings, who spoke last week as a family care physician in Santa Cruz,
she's a good partner of mine. She manages a lot of patients on hormones, and then they come to see me for surgery. And then they go back to see her for other medical issues. So endocrinology, it's surprisingly not the go-to person or place, although they can provide equally good care. Secondly, I think the majority of my patients transition socially first and then start hormones. It's different for different people, but it's not soon after social transition, that's living daily as a woman, that they start taking hormones. Some people start taking hormones early on. They find that it just helps their anxiety, and they just sort of physically and mentally feel better. And then they're well enough to kind of brace themselves to start dressing as a woman and going out in public. So it varies. I think everyone, I ask all my patients about this, and I'm always interested to hear different pathways. But my sense is that overall they come very close to one another, but not necessarily at the same time.
I'm curious about the mental health piece.
So
how that fits in with
them. Well, the mental health piece, not everybody in my experience is in significant need of mental, like crash mental health care. Some people go to mental health providers really to get their referral letters for surgery. A lot of patients will see someone early on in the transition just for help with coping and to reviewing strategies. And then they do great for a long time. And then they start looking for surgery, and they go back to someone really just for their letters. Other people have other significant, you know, suicide attempt is very high in this population. So I'm not downplaying mental health at all. That I'm just saying a lot of people do really well after they kind of get sorted out with social transition and transition with hormones, and they really thrive like everyone else and lead normal lives. And then they come back to mental health for their letters. So it's, again, different pathways for different people.
I think the piece that is missing here is the support, because being able to get the support, not only socially but also psychologically, can make a more successful transition.
Well, I totally agree, and that's implicit. But I'm just, the point I'm making is that the need for that from a mental health professional is different for different people. Not everyone requires that. So I totally agree that for transition, like all of us, family support, partner support, community support, absolutely, no question, extremely important. And a mental health professional is a big role. They play a big role in that for some, but not everyone. A lot of people do well getting support elsewhere. But support is certainly important. Any other questions? Nothing else. Well, it's been a pleasure for both of us to talk to you tonight. And if you have any questions, you can contact us online. This is my email address. Contact Dr. Satterwhite, and be happy to talk offline. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.